I'm Brian Ellison, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. In modern America, mass shootings have become part of our common life. But it's impossible to know where or when they'll happen, so hospitals and emergency rooms everywhere, including Kansas City, have to always be on the ready. Today, we learn how local hospitals prepare for trauma faced by dozens or more victims and their caregivers in a fire or shooting, an accident or tornado they hope never comes. Then, we hear a different take on music history, this one from the bottom up. Whatever you've thought of Bach or Beethoven, our guest wants you to consider outsiders and rebels as music's true source of innovation and change. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. El Paso, Virginia Beach, Dayton, Stoneman Douglas High School, Tree of Life Synagogue. The recitation of recent years' mass shootings conjures up images of sorrow and shock, of flashing police lights and grieving families. Those incidents also came with other stories, accounts from hospitals where emergency room doctors and surgeons and nurses came together to respond, striving to respond with perfection to something that nobody ever expects to happen. Today, we're talking about how local hospitals prepare for the unthinkable. Dr. Robert Winfield is Division Chief for Trauma, Acute Care Surgery, and Critical Care at the University of Kansas Health System. Dr. Winfield, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And also Dr. Mark Sinclair, who's an orthopedic surgeon at Children's Mercy Hospital. Dr. Sinclair, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
You know, I was reading this week about the hospitals that received most of the victims of the Las Vegas shooting a couple of years ago. 58 people were killed, 800 people were injured. And those hospitals, you know, they had conducted drills, but nothing could have really prepared them for what they encountered. I'm curious what you saw, what you thought when you saw those first reports about a casualty count of that nature happening at a hospital not so different from the ones where you work, Dr. Winfield?
Yeah, I think when you look at that from the outside, one of the first things that strikes you is the sheer volume of people, and you wonder how a community is prepared for that. And one of the things that I think it's important to understand in a mass casualty situation is that although Dr. Sinclair and I both work at trauma centers, in a mass casualty like this, every hospital in the community becomes a trauma center, mm-hmm. and everyone has to be prepared to respond as a community to an event like that.
Yeah, I have to think that the hard part of preparing for something like that is your deep wish that it would not happen, and having to make yourself think about it must be a very hard thing.
It is a little bit, but it's actually preparation that will help you if something like that would ever to happen. So while you hope that all the preparation that you do for these type of things will never be necessary, to not prepare sets you up for a real problem.
You both work in trauma centers, but I'm curious, has preparation for a mass shooting and this kind of event always been part of what trauma centers do, or is this something that's really stepped up in the last few years?
What I would say is that I think everyone is more aware of the differences in handling a mass shooting relative to other types of disaster or mass casualty situations. A mass shooting tends to involve a lot more surgical casualties than does a building collapse, for example, or a weather-related calamity. And so from that standpoint, it forces you to think a little bit differently about how to respond to something like that.
When did you, Dr. Sinclair, first start getting into this kind of preparation and thinking about the unthinkable?
Well, it was a couple of years ago when I was head of the trauma committee for our national pediatric orthopedic organization, and I was voluntold, really, to give a presentation at the National Orthopedic Surgery Meeting on pediatric considerations in mass casualty situations. And so I started doing research to prepare for that. And as I did more and more, I was like, ooh, we need to get our act together. We need to be prepared for all of these potential hazards that we could face, whether they be mass shootings or natural disasters or anything like that.
You know, there was a poll last week of, or last year rather, of emergency physicians that said something like more than 90% of them don't think their hospitals are adequately prepared for a mass shooting or mass casualty incident. Why is it so hard to be prepared, Dr. Winfield?
Well, I think it's difficult to simulate that environment is the first thing. It's also difficult to stop your regular business and do an effective simulation. And so taking people away from the already important patient care issues that they're dealing with on a day-to-day basis, and then asking them to suspend that to simulate what might happen, that's a hard leap for people to make sometimes. And I think that's probably the hardest part of preparing, is convincing people that unless we drill this now, we are not going to be ready if something like this happens in our community.
And how different is this conversation when we're talking about pediatric care, Dr. Sinclair? Obviously, school shootings, sadly, is part of this conversation, and it's where a number of these mass shootings have taken place. That introduces you to a different kind of patient.
Yeah, I think there are probably two major issues. One is the physiologic difference of children. Their blood volume is much lower. Their physiologic requirements are different than that of adults. Unless you are dealing with children on a regular basis, sometimes you're not prepared for that little difference.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's the incredible baggage of you've got parents and people attached to these children that may be victimized in one of these situations.
Not to mention very upset.
Oh, my God. Yeah. So to manage that situation, I mean, there's always issues with families showing up at the emergency room, in any mass casualty. But in this, you can only imagine the amount of emotional charge that's going on.
Yeah, I think a lot of Kansas Cityans, when they think about mass casualty situations, their minds instantly go back to the Hyatt disaster, to the collapse inside the lobby of the Hyatt Hotel now decades ago. How have our local hospitals changed in how they would respond to a mass casualty situation since that day that really shook up the city?
Well, I would say I've practiced in several different environments, and the regional preparation that occurs in Kansas City is outstanding. The coordination between the trauma centers, between other facilities in the area, we drill together. We really, I think, are about as prepared as any community can be for a major mass casualty event.
We're talking with doctors in local emergency rooms, trauma centers, about how they are preparing for the possibility of a mass shooting or another mass casualty here in the Kansas City area. You're listening to KCUR's Up to Date. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske. I want to talk about some of the details of how this preparation takes place. How do you go about getting ready? Is this book learning, or do you actually put people in simulated situations to try to know how they're going to react?
It's all of the above, certainly at our hospital. And I think hospitals who are actively preparing for these sorts of events, they do all of those things. And so we teach courses. We teach the American College of Surgeons Disaster Management and Emergency Preparedness course. That's really for healthcare providers, although lay people can attend that as well to learn more about a hospital response to mass casualties. We have an emergency management committee that spends all of its time thinking about these difficult situations that we may face. And then we do different types of drills. So we do tabletop drills where we sit everybody in the room and we talk about what if this happens, or if this happens, what are you going to do? And then we do full-scale practice drills too, where we prepare for the possibility, for example, of hazardous material exposure, and we set up a chemical decontamination tent right out in the parking lot outside of the emergency department. And we get the people who would be responding to a situation like that the actual hands-on practice of engaging in it.
You have actors play the patients?
We do. Actually, usually it's volunteers from within the health system, but yes, we do.
I have to think that that's got to be that has its own sort of trauma for the people involved, potentially, wouldn't it? I mean, this must be very hard for some people to go through that kind of training.
Well, yeah, but it's important to prepare yourself in a situation that you're not used to,
Yeah.
So you've got healthcare professionals who've been doing this for decades, but they're used to taking care of emergencies that are typical to our community. When you have a situation like this, it's just quite different. So if mm-hmm. you don't prepare yourself, you're going to not at all be ready to rise to the occasion, at the point where your community needs you the most.
Well, what is on that list of things that you prepare for? You mentioned exposure to a chemical contamination, for example. What else in recent days has your hospital been preparing for?
At our place, so every year we perform a hazards vulnerability analysis. And so we run down an exhaustive list of the things that could happen here in Kansas City, what we might have to prepare for. At or near the top of that list is always weather-related phenomena.
Right. Tornadoes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And how about for you at Children's Mercy?
It's the same thing as we're in the same area.
Right.
So, you know, we're most concerned about weather events and specifically tornadoes. So that's at the top of our hazard vulnerability analysis that all hospitals are required to do by law. But then you have to also consider at Children's Mercy how these things would affect our pediatric population and how if you had multiple casualties at a space, how would you separate the children to go here and the adults to go here and how you may transport and communicate in these types of situations?
Well, I'm guessing that even the different kinds of incidents that might occur are going to affect which members of the hospital staff are most called upon. You're an orthopedic surgeon. That's going to be different than someone who treats perhaps shooting victims who are bleeding out.
You know, I think one of the things to remember is that we start in a common path in medical school. And so things like first aid, basic life support, hemorrhage control is a big one that we've been emphasizing at KU lately, teaching people how to apply pressure in tourniquets and things like that, that these skills are pretty readily translatable. And so although I chose to specialize in trauma surgery, my general surgery colleagues, my orthopedic surgeons, vascular surgeons, everyone chips in a situation like this because that background allows them to deliver life-saving care.
You know, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, that being said, in these situations, you want your people to do what they do most all the time. You don't want to have in such a bizarre situation people doing things that they're not used to doing. So again, back to preparation, you try to get people in a situation that they're most comfortable in a very uncomfortable situation.
So we hear sometimes when we hear about trauma centers, we hear about level one trauma centers, level two trauma centers. What does that mean? How important is that to this kind of regional planning?
Sure. So those refer to the resources that a particular institution possesses. And so a level one is the highest level, possesses the greatest amount of resources to manage a complex trauma patient. Level two, similar degree of resources. It's availability of those resources that varies a bit there. And then on down the line down to level 4, 5, 6, you can go. Different states have different regulations and definitions on those things. But it comes down to that. And so when you're talking about a regional plan, those are the places that are expected to manage the most complex injuries. Now, that said, things can very quickly turn into something else where if, again, a center's closer, they become a triaging center for these mass casualty victims.
Because people are going to turn up at whatever hospital they can get to. Frankly.
Right, exactly. Yeah, the majority of people, in fact, will show up at the closest facility in those situations.
How much work do institutions like yours that do have a lot of resources and highly trained people who have talked about these issues work with other hospitals, maybe community hospitals, clinics in the community who may not have that level of trauma certification, but who very well might be the place that people go in these situations.
Right. So, and that's why there's a regional council to try to facilitate this type of transport. And so, as far as the levels of trauma care, a lot of it has to do with the time critical nature of trauma, just like other diagnoses like myocardial infarction and stroke. Trauma is time critical, and you need to get to the proper place in the proper time frame, but you may not start there. So that's why the regional communication is very important in this.
How else are these trauma centers connected? What is that regional council all about? Is it just hospitals, or does that involve other agencies in the community as well?
Oh, fire, EMS, all of these things are connected through the regional council.
With all of these different parties involved in the process, who makes the call in a time of tragedy, in a moment where someone's got to take the lead?
Right. So there's kind of a complex process that goes into that. But in general, what it is the first responder will establish an incident command. And then from there, they can ultimately be relieved by the person who holds that position. But it kind of starts from that point where the first people on scene end up kind of starting the process off. And then it allows for some time to organize what the remainder of the response is going to look like.
You know, a lot of people thinking about what would be a real nightmare scenario would be one where the hospital itself is the site of an attack or a disaster of some kind. Do hospitals prepare for that?
Absolutely. So, you know, one of the most recent situation that we had was the tornado that occurred in Joplin, and that did take one of the hospitals offline.
Direct
there.
Hit.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so that's part of the things that you plan for. So a disaster, as far as a hospital is concerned, is when you can't provide the services that you need to be able to provide. And again, this is where the pre-planning comes in on what's going to happen with evacuations, if the hospital actually has to evacuate patients. Or if you're just offline, what's going to happen with where the patients who need you are going to have to go?
I wonder, are there preventive measures in place at the hospital? Do you think about security at the hospital in terms of its need to be ready to accommodate victims rather than become a place where there are victims?
That's a critical component of the planning process, is making sure that the hospital can remain functional. And so security, law enforcement, coordination with them is essential in these situations.
I wonder about something else too, and that's the psychological impact on, particularly on hospital staff. How do you account for that possibility? Obviously, in the moment of a disaster, adrenaline takes over, people rise to the occasion, but there's always an aftermath.
So agreed, and that's true whether you're dealing with one trauma or multiple traumas. Obviously, the severity of a multiple casualty event is going to affect a lot more people. And so, again, that's something that we prepare for as well with our chaplain services, with psychological and psychiatric assistance for people who have been through these things. And it's not a short-term process. It's a long-term healing process.
Yeah, but debriefing is very important after these events. Not only do you learn things from how you responded, but also you can attend to the staff that responded to the event and their needs.
So can you give me an example of a recent training event where what was the scenario that you played out? You mentioned a chemical contamination sort of event. What has Children's Mercy drilled on in recent days?
Well, the recent tabletop or basically discussion-based drill that we had is more tornado-related. Mm-hmm. and how that would be affected. But, you know, getting back to our topic of mass shooting, we'll be drilling that one in a couple weeks as well in a more hospital-wide drill.
Well, let's talk about that unfortunate possibility of mass shootings. What specifically would go into the preparation for that? How is that kind of disaster different than a tornado hitting the city?
Yeah, again, the issue with a mass shooting is that there will tend to be a higher volume of surgical type injuries. So patients who need immediate control of bleeding is the thing that we have to prepare for. And so for us, what we've had to look at is how are we going to quickly triage these patients in that setting, knowing that these patients need immediate hemorrhage control by and large, and how then will we mobilize the resources necessary to provide that hemorrhage control to the patients? And so things like looking at our call trees and figuring out how, and it's different depending on the time of day that you're talking about as well. If something happens in the middle of the day on a weekday, our operating rooms are universally going to be full. Mm-hmm. So how do we deal with that? Patients already asleep on the operating table undergoing procedures and
a non-emergency
surgery, needing to clear space for patients who do have emergent situations. Whereas if this happens at 2 a.m. on Sunday morning, the operating rooms are empty, but there's nobody there to run them. And so these require very different planning, not different planning processes, but a different response and a different way to mobilize the personnel and the resources that are necessary.
All the more true at Children's Mercy, where your patients might be pediatric?
Yeah, it's a similar type of situation at Children's. And again, the only situation is that you have, you know, because hemorrhage is the cause of death that's most preventable in these situations, you have to be able to prepare for massive transfusion protocols and these type of things to then stabilize them enough to then have surgery.
And do hospitals that are prepared for these situations have enough supplies to accommodate, whether it's supplies like blood or bandages? I mean, how could you possibly have enough stock to anticipate every possible situation?
So for us, and I'm sure the same is it's true at Children's Mercy, but we first have a stockpile that's available, and then we have...
It's in a basement somewhere. You don't usually pay any attention to it, but if you needed it, it's there.
Correct. And on top of that, we have contractual agreements with different suppliers in the event of a mass casualty to provide those things to us at a time of need.
I guess I'm curious about one other thing, which is... In that moment, there's been a mass shooting. Citizens in the community want to help. We remember after 9/11 the rush of people to go and donate blood. What would you want citizens to do in the case of a mass casualty? Do you want them to come to the hospital? Do you want them to help in some way in the community?
Well, if they're in the vicinity of the disaster, then some training in immediate procedure first aid is exceptionally helpful. So if you're on the scene, people can really help a lot by knowing what to do to stop hemorrhage and stop the bleed campaign that is developed after the Sandy Hook shooting.
Kind of basic first aid.
Some basic first aid. But no, you really don't want then a lot of well-meaning people showing up at the hospital and say, how can I help? It just kind of adds to the burden.
Yeah. Dr. Winfield?
I would agree with that. I think, you know, at that point, what we want to do is make sure that that the scene stabilized, that we're able to continue normal function. And the more people that show up at the hospital, they just create more chaos and it's more difficult to control.
Do you ever get to the point, as we wrap up here, do you get to the point where you have trained enough, where you feel like, okay, we can check that off, we are ready if this should happen?
I don't think you could ever really prepare enough. I think that every situation is going to have unique aspects to it that you would have to think about. Some things are going to come up that you weren't necessarily prepared for. And again, as Dr. Sinclair pointed out, that debriefing and after action is critically important in that, and in kind of thinking about what the next step is to prepare for, what to do better the next time around.
Yeah, I would completely agree with that. I don't think you can ever be prepared for these type of scenarios. You can prepare as much as you can, but there's always going to be something that kind of catches you by surprise.
That's Dr. Mark Sinclair. He's an orthopedic surgeon at Children's Mercy Hospital. Also with us, Dr. Robert Winfield, Division Chief for Trauma Acute Care Surgery and Critical Care at the University of Kansas Health System. Thanks to both of you for being with us.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you.
Coming up, the history of music is about notes and harmonies, tempos and beats, but it's also about oppression and social change and violence and sex and power. We'll talk about a new look at music's subversive history when we come back. I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. Welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske. Do you not like Mondays? Well, if you subscribe to the UpToDate newsletter, you will have at least one thing to look forward to every Monday: exclusive content from Steve Kraske and the team in your inbox. You can go to kcur.org/Kraske to sign up. Speaking of that guy, he returns tomorrow for a conversation with a top foreign policy decision maker in the Obama administration, Susan Rice. She'll discuss the national security advisor role that she filled and how she navigated that office as an African-American woman. Today, what do you think of when you think of music history? Gregorian chant, maybe? Bach and Beethoven? The Beatles? Our guest today thinks maybe the way we've been thinking about music, its origins, its impact, its importance, has been wrong. We've been glossing over or maybe willfully suppressing its real roots as a vehicle of ideas the powerful consider shameful or dangerous. Ted Gioia is a music historian and the author of 11 books on music, most recently of the audaciously titled Music. He joins us this morning from Dallas. Ted, good morning.
Well, thank you, Brian. Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. And I should say the subtitle of that book is A Subversive History. What's so subversive about it?
Well, you know, I never intended to turn music history upside down. I've never seen myself as a revisionist historian. I always try to speak common sense.
Sure.
And tell the plain truth. And my original goal was to write the history of music from the point of view of everyday life and the great masses of people who aren't featured in music history books. Most music history books tell us what the king and queen did or what the nobility listened to or the people who were patrons and were able to hire famous composers. Mm-hmm. And I wondered, what was musical life like for the great masses of people? And I, as I dug into this, and the I've got to say, I started researching this book in 1991, so that tells you...
It took you a little while.
how difficult it was to actually find these things, because these people aren't talked about in music history books. So I had to dig into other sources, travel literature, anthropology, medieval chronicles, anything, Egyptian Book of the Dead, Herodotus, whatever I could find to dig into the real life of the people. And I found that, to my surprise, that musical innovations had come from the common people and generally showed up there 50 or 100 years before they entered music history with the nobles. And so I felt I had to point this out and write a history of music that turned it upside down and show that musical innovation comes from the bottom up.
So, and you've written, when we celebrate the songs of previous eras, the respectable music of cultural elites gets almost all the attention, while the subversive efforts of outsiders and rebels fall from view. How did that happen?
Well, it's a curious fact that in our own time, we're very familiar with this. We see in our own lifetime how music comes from unexpected places, from the underclass and from the outsider. So if you're a hip-hop fan, you know that hip-hop is not the music of elites, or if you were into punk rock. Or take the British invasion and rock and roll. The British invasion didn't come from Buckingham Palace. It didn't come from 10 Downing Street. It came from Liverpool, one of the poorest parts of England.
Yeah.
And we see in our own lifetime, what we don't realize is this has always been the case. I mean, go back, take Bach, for example. Bach is considered the epitome of the establishment composer, the great Lutheran who made music for God and his nation.
Mm-hmm.
But people who are even great fans of Bach don't know about the month he spent in jail or the time he got into a knife fight on the street.
Wait, I didn't know about that.
No, there are, or the extent of his beer drinking. You know, he went on a business trip once for 1 week and he billed his church for beer enough to purchase 8 gallons.
Well, some of us might respect him all the more.
No. And there another time he had a contract and demanded free beer from the brewery. He was constantly in disciplinary problems with his bosses. Now, the image of Bach that we're put to today is him as a respectable individual, this esteemed elite. But the case with him and all the leaders in music history, it's a very similar story. They start as outsiders and then they're cleaned up. The cleaning up is an act of distortion. So in my music history book, I've tried to show where does music innovation really come from? Where does it originate? What are the forces? And how is that different from this respectable story that we've been told again and again?
But how different is that from other art forms? I mean, is in some ways that true of all forms of art? Or is there something unique and special about music that makes it subject to this influence from the bottom up?
Music is different from art forms. It's almost more of a physiological force in our body than a cultural artifact. And that's why I keep on getting to these elements in music history that have been written out, because they're embarrassing. They're shameful. The connections to sex, violence, trance, altered mind states, healing, magic, supernatural elements, generational conflict, warfare. These are embarrassing, but they're actually at the root of music. You know, Darwin thought all music came from sexual selection.
Say more. How so?
Music was for mating. He looked at bird calls. He says all music is for sexual reasons. Now, when I first read this, I laughed at it. I thought, no, that can't be true. That's reductionist. That's absurd. But you know there's been an immense amount of evidence now that he's right. A lot of it just in the last 10 years. We now understand what happens to your body when you listen to music.
Mm-hmm.
For example, one thing, your body releases this hormone called oxytocin. And oxytocin changes how you view the world. You become much more trusting of people around you. And that's why people go on dates, on romantic interludes, to dance or to hear music. It actually bonds people together. There's a physiological link between music and sexuality.
And
that
yet
doesn't exist in painting or sculpture. And the same thing is true with violence.
Because which is quite a pairing to say sex and violence
together
are the
into warfare gangs. Our earliest hunting ancestors had music to help them hunt. And this is why music, they actually send the musicians on the battlefield. It brings the troops together. And they don't send a painter on the battlefield. Right. They don't send an architect on the battlefield. There's a drummer out there. There's a trumpeter with a bugle.
Yeah.
These aren't coincidences, but they show the linkage between music and these powerful physiological forces. And because of that, the history of music has to take these into account or else it falsifies the whole history.
You, when you say this is a history of music that you tell, you really mean it. You actually start at the beginning, as in the very beginning of the world, the moment of creation or the formation of the world. What does that have to do with music? Are you there? Yeah, I was starting.
Hey, Brian, have I lost you?
I was starting to think that he couldn't hear me, and that turns out to be true. Can you hear me? Can you hear me, Ted? We are having trouble with Ted hearing me. Not sure why that would be. So we're going to try to reestablish that connection. And we're going to take a little break while we try to do that. Stay with us. You're listening to KCUR's Up to Date. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back. I'm Brian Ellison in for Steve Kraske. We're talking today about a subversive history of music with music historian Ted Gioia. Ted, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, I apologize for our technical difficulties in connecting with you here a moment ago. We were talking about the origins of music and its connection with sex and violence, but your musical history actually goes back even further to the real origins of music, to the origins of the whole world. What's the connection between music as you see it and creation or the formation of everything?
Well, in our scientific account of the origin of the universe, it goes back to a big bang, like this big drum beat, sort of a percussion hit that started the whole thing off.
It's interesting to think of the big bang as a musical moment. It's a big percussion moment.
In fact, well, you know, it's interesting. It was first heard over the radio. You know, in 1964, scientists got the idea that some of the background sounds they could detect on the radio were actually the sounds of the universe starting. So they were listening. I mean, that was a lot of interesting things happened on the radio in 1964. You know, you had the British invasion and the Beatles, and Louis Armstrong had a hit record. But the strangest of all was if you tuned into the right radio station, you could hear the birth of the whole universe. But, you know, it's interesting. All the great mythologies also talk about music as a source of creation. Hmm. If you go into the Aboriginal culture of Australia, they talk about the ancestors who sang the universe into existence. And you find the same thing in Native American traditions all over the world, in the Hindu tradition. And I think there's a reason for this. Music is a force of creation. It's also a force of destruction. And that's recurred again and again throughout history. You know, I talk about the connection between music and violence. And people will tell me, well, Ted, that was long, long ago. But they don't understand that even today, the single biggest investment of the U.S. government in music is military bands. Hmm. They spend three times as much on military bands as the whole budget of the National Endowment for the Arts. So even today, there's this invariable and inescapable connection between music and warfare and violence that has not disappeared.
How did music sound in its earliest manifestations? Do we know that? Do we have any idea what the first music was?
The oldest music that is recorded goes back to fertility rites in ancient times. And once again, there's this connection to sexuality. There was an idea that these songs would lead to prosperity and fertility in the land, but they rooted in human fertility. There was this thing called the sacred marriage ritual in which the king actually had sex with a goddess. Now, it's hard to track down a goddess, so the high priestess had to step in, and there was this coupling, and there were these songs. In fact, some of these songs are so explicit, I could not even tell you the lyrics on the radio. Hmm. You would probably get the show shut down.
Well, thank you for that.
This is interesting, though, is if you look at music today, it hasn't changed.
Yeah.
You know, someone did a study, and they showed that 92% of hit songs refer to sexuality. And in fact, the average hit song makes 10.5 what they call reproductive references. That's the word the scientists use. There were reproductive references in the song. Those were the dirty parts. Mm. It's not just shake your booty. It's a reproductive reference.
Yeah.
And can this be coincidence? I mean, there are many things you could sing about. So this, once again, this connection going back to the earliest roots of the music that's still present today.
But, you know, that you make the point that a lot of popular music is about these things, sex and violence, too. It doesn't appear that we're actually repressing that very much. How is it that this is so subversive? What is it that we're not seeing or not understanding through music's development that isn't so obvious today?
Well, people tell me, well, Ted, music's just entertainment. It doesn't really have that kind of powerful impact that you say it does. But that's not true at all. Every week I read about someone somewhere in the world being jailed or in trouble because of music. In Russia, Putin cracks down on music. In many parts of the Middle East, people are put in jail because of YouTube music videos they have. Just this week I heard about a composer in Hong Kong who's created this protest anthem, and he has to become anonymous because it's so dangerous to be the composer of this song. And so there's this idea that music is just diversion and entertainment. That's not true at all. Music is one of the most powerful cultural forces we have. It's been a source of human rights and civil liberties long before there were constitutions or the Magna Carta. It's been a political force in ways that people don't really realize. And that's one of the things I bring out in my book. Even a love song can be a political song. I mean, look at the Stonewall riots that were the breakthrough moment in the gay rights agenda. And that started with the right to dance at a nightclub. So music is subversive even today.
Yeah, why do you say that even love songs are political songs? That's one of the points you make in the final chapter of your book, which is called "This Is Not a Manifesto." So that manifesto, one of the points you make is that even love songs are political songs. Why do you say that?
Well, this is one of the reasons why people need to have their broader understanding of music. When I say a political song, people think, well, Bob Dylan protesting the Vietnam War, or Joan Baez, or Woody Guthrie. But in fact, no type of song has been more political than the love song.
What do you mean? Why?
When young people want to expand their freedom and their autonomy, it happens through love songs. That's why parents were so threatened when Elvis showed up. You know, when the Beatles were on the Ed Sullivan Show, and I'm old enough to remember this, parents were afraid of that. But every song the Beatles performed that night was a love song. And this is what got parents especially scared, is because this is the area where people first demand personal autonomy and control over their lives. And if you go back into the medieval period, for 1,000 years, Christianity was able to prohibit and ban every secular love song. And this was a high priority for them because they understood the power of this music. So when we say a political song and a love song, they're not opposite. Often they intersect.
You mentioned Christianity, and I have to say, I think when a lot of us think about music history, we think about religious music or sacred music, the so-called great composers who much of their repertoire was religious music for actual worship services. How does religion intersect with this idea that music history, when it's truly told, is subversive? It seems very, very holy, very pure.
Well, music itself in the religious spheres always borrows from the sexual music of the secular world.
How so?
You know, when St. Francis had this was the first vernacular song in Italian by St. Francis, and he's singing about the divine world, but he's borrowing from the methods of the troubadours who sang about love and sex. You know, when the operas came out, they were all about sex and violence, and the Vatican tried to create their own holy operas using them as an influence. In my own lifetime, I saw churches adopt guitar masses. They need to borrow from these secular songs, because this is where the disruptive energy is generated in culture, and religion needs to tap into it. But also I'll point out that even in the religious world, these songs were dangerous and innovations were dangerous. You know, for example, there's a fellow named Guido d'Arezzo, who was the first person to figure out how to write down music. He was a monk in Italy.
Yeah.
He had threats on his life because he had figured out how to write down music.
Yeah.
Because this threatened the power brokers. Previously, if you wanted to learn to sing, you had to go to a choir director or a teacher. Now you could learn with a piece of paper. So all the innovations, even in the religious world, and I show this in my book, were very dangerous, disruptive, and subversive in their time.
I have to say that if we skip forward to American musical history, that doesn't seem like such a radical idea. I mean, we know that the songs of slavery were the early voices for liberation. We know about folk artists and artists like Bob Dylan, who you mentioned. Are we understanding the place of those genres properly? Don't we all know that American music has been an agent of change and transformation?
What people don't understand is how long this has been going on. Now, in American music history, we understand fully that slaves and the descendants of slaves created the great innovations of the last 100 years, which came out of the black community: jazz, blues, soul, R&B, hip-hop. What people don't realize is this was happening thousands of years ago. For example, if you're a music student, one of the first things you learn are the musical modes. These are like basic scales of music, and they all have names. Mm-hmm. The Phrygian mode, the Lydian mode. Now, what people aren't taught is the Phrygians and the Lydians were the slaves in the Greek world. And they had these powerful musical tools that were exciting and disruptive back then. And so even the musical modes at the root of our musical experience are named after slave populations. So this is part of this recurring thing. And I could give you other examples over thousands of years. And then finally, with this great flowering of American music created by the descendants of slave, it's a recurring theme in music history and the engine of innovation.
You tell a lot of stories in your book about familiar songs that people are likely to know, but whose origins we may have misunderstood or not been told the full story about. So you write, for example, about Hound Dog, which I think we all know is a fun little song by Elvis Presley.
Well, yes. No, and this is a song that came out of the black community and Big Mama Thornton. And you needed to have someone from the white mainstream to bring it over to the mass market, which Elvis did. But there are many other songs like that that have a similar story. Take the song Greensleeves, for example.
So what child is this?
Simple folk song, very innocent. But it originated with prostitutes. And if you ask my love, you've thrown me off discourteously. And the green sleeves are the women that would take their customers out into these grassy fields for sex.
And yet that's become the beloved Christmas carol, What Child Is This?
Well, no, absolutely. And so, you know, these are embarrassing, shameful aspects of music history. But if you leave them out, you don't understand the engine of change and innovation in music.
Well, I want to ask about a couple of those other items in that closing non-manifesto in your book. You say musical innovation spreads like a virus and usually by the same means through close contact between groups from different places. How so?
Well, you know, long ago, early in my life, I was involved in management consulting with the Boston Consulting Group. This is like when I was a young pup. And they taught me how to trace innovations in new products and technologies. And they had these mathematical formulas where you could plot an innovation. So if a new computer comes out and 1,000 were sold last week and next week it's going to be 5,000, you can predict the innovation over the course of years. Now, this was the interesting thing. The mathematical formulas they used all came out of tracking diseases and viruses. So this is where all the mathematics for tracking innovation come from, because innovations spread like a virus. Now, I had a great moment of enlightenment years later when I'm studying the birth of jazz in New Orleans, and I found New Orleans was the unhealthiest city in the United States. An average lifespan for a black man back then was like 36 years. And it was unhealthy for the same reasons that create musical innovation: diverse people from all over the world coming together in close contact. And so I realized at that point that this was the formula both for the spreading of viruses and the spreading of musical innovation. Now, interestingly enough, today we talk about a cultural idea or a song going viral. Well, that's not just a metaphor. The same circumstances that spur innovation in music also spread disease.
You've written yourself about work songs and healing songs and love songs. You've written the bestseller, The History of Jazz. What's next for you, Ted Gioia?
Well, right now I'm very interested in the history of rhythm, because as I've gone into this, it's fascinating to see how rhythm is this power that's embodied in music, but then can carry over to our own lives. You know, if you listen to music, your brain waves begin to match the rhythm of the music. And this explains why people get into trance states when they listen to music. It also explains why shamans were able to have these states of ecstasy that they got into from music. And so this is one of the areas of interest. It's explored somewhat in my new book on music history, but that might be the subject of my next book.
Well, very good. Ted Gioia is a music historian and the author of 11 books on music, most recently, Music, A Subversive History. He joined us this morning from Dallas. Ted, thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you for having me as your guest.
Yesterday, I spoke with jazz legend Bobby Watson. He's hanging up his professor's hat at the end of this academic year and hitting the road. You can hear that and previous episodes of our program online at kcur.org/up-to-date. Find and follow us on Twitter. We're at @KCURUpToDate, and I'm at @PTSBrian. Also, don't forget to like KCUR on Facebook. Steve Kraske will be back tomorrow, and he'll sit down with two TV stars from Night Court and The Waltons, actors Michael Learned and Charlie Robinson, who are in town for a production at the New Theater. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Jamie Hobbs. I'm Brian Ellison, and you are up to date.